Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
You know, if you look at the marital status or like how many Indian households are like two-person households, and it's like almost 90%. Like most Indian kids come from a household with two parents. But I wonder if we came from a community where people talked about mental health, talked about toxic masculinity, and, you know, refused abuse as just a part of life. And that's just how it is. And, you know, marriage is either going to be whatever it is. I wonder if that number would be greatly reduced, if there would be more divorces in the Indian community because of that, or even maybe less marriages in the first place at a young age. It's just all of it is so messy and it's so intertwined that when you see something horrible happen to someone else or to yourself, you just don't even know which part of the system to blame.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Vipassana, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about your story because you wrote in, and when I read it, it was one of those sort of, hell yes, I want to find out more about this person moments. So on that note, I want to start by asking you, where in the world were you born and raised, and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career thus far?
That's a good question. I was born in Downers Grove, Illinois. My mother had immigrated to Naperville, which is just a couple of minutes away, when she was arranged to be married to my dad, who was living in Naperville at the time. And shortly after I was born, my parents got a divorce. So I moved around a lot following that. So following Naperville, I lived in New York for a little bit. I lived in New Jersey. I lived in India. So that was really hard too, being an American kid and then moving to your homeland. And you look like everyone, but you don't talk like everyone. And everyone's wondering why. And then after that, I moved to Memphis, Tennessee. So I would say the impact that that had on me had mostly to do with like my mom's marital status. So when I was, like I said, shortly after I was born, my parents got a divorce. But then a couple years after, when I was about 5, my mother got remarried. And this was her second marriage. And she was married to just a very abusive person. And that was when I moved to New Jersey. And I never really thought that, I always just found my situation to be different than others. Like, I constantly romanticized the idea of coming from a nuclear family. Like, I wanted a sibling and I wanted my dad to be married to my mom and I wanted a backyard. Like, I was also like, I grew up in apartments my whole life too. So I was very much into the idea of a quintessential American life, and I didn't have that. And on top of that, I'm Indian, I'm brown. So I was just like moving around just was another. It was like no matter where I moved, that sense of isolation followed me. And when I moved to India, we actually moved to India because my mother got a divorce from her second husband. And we really felt like we just needed to escape. We needed to get away. And that's when we moved in with my grandparents. And that was, I remember the first day of school. I went to a K-12 school, and which is very different than American school, which is like elementary, middle school, high school. And I remember being so small. I was 9 and seeing all these big kids around me, and I freaked out. Like, I had gone from being this kid who loved school to being the kid like clinging to their mother's clothes and screaming in front of everyone. I was like a very easygoing child, and I took a complete 180. And I remember saying, please don't make me go in there. Please don't make me go in there. And when I went in there, my life changed. And the way I saw myself also changed forever. I think that's when a lot of like self-doubt and anxiety started to form in my life. And then when I turned 14, my mother got remarried, and for the third time. And the last time, maybe, who knows? but my stepdad is an amazing human being. And he was living in Memphis at the time. So that's when we moved from India to Memphis. And I was in Chennai, India, which is in the south. And Memphis was really interesting because while in India, I really just missed America. Like, I missed the comfort of America. And I say that because, you know, India is very different. There's a lot of people. The government is just like works so differently. You know, the way communities form is just so different, too, than in America. And I constantly felt like everyone was watching each other. And I would watch all these high school TV shows again, you know, that kind of reminder of the quintessential American life that I didn't have. And I would always think, oh, I can't wait to go back to America so I can like go to high school and have a locker and have a boyfriend and like all these like very arbitrary things that I associated with like normal. But when I moved back to the States, like I went to a school that was like 85% Black. I had never seen a TV show with characters that were like all Black. So it's like what I had thought was America had completely shifted into like this, again, another cultural shock of like, wow, this is America's very different than what I had in my head. This is another side of it that I wasn't seeing. And mm-hmm. Going to school in Memphis taught me, I mean, that was when I think I also started really solidifying like who I was as an American, but then also like my place in the Indian community. Because the Indian American community I was in was very much like model minority. Like all of our kids, like all the parents were like, all our kids are going to go to Ivy League schools. They're going to play two. And I was like, my mom's been married 3 times. Like I'm already out of the, you know, I'm already different than all of you. And they knew that, you know, so that was just when I had this realization that like, I am not going to make it if I continuously try to fit myself into this idea in my head of what's normal. I'm only going to make it if I accept where I've come from, what my story is, what my family situation is. And that's the only way I could ever find contentment.
Mm. Wow. Okay. So numerous questions come from that, as you might imagine. Yeah, you're a child of divorce, and I'm guessing your mom is from a generation, just based on, you know, kind of what your age is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't have a 16-year age gap, but, you know, in that generation, divorce was highly stigmatized, mm-hmm. you know, in our parents' generation. There are people who stay together, not because they should stay together, but because of the fact that they are going to be judged, you know, criticized and shamed by the communities they come from. I mean, I think I remember writing this after the whole Indian matchmaking experience, saying that, you know, we effectively put a scarlet letter on people who are divorced in the Indian community. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, witnessing that as a child, what
was the experience for your mother in terms of reactions from, you know, the community, reactions from family? And how did you guys adapt to that?
I'd say the biggest thing was people seeing my mother as a failure. And then me seeing myself also as a failure as a result of that. And as I grew up and I started seeing how unhappy a lot of people were in their marriages, whether that's like my aunts and uncles or another Indian kid's parents, I realized that being married to someone does not have to be tied into your self-worth. And that's how I adapted. I, you know, seeing unhappiness in other people and realizing that people are keeping themselves in a certain situation, not because they think it, not because it feels good, but because they feel like that's what they have to do. And in their heads, what feels worse is being stigmatized. And they're not wrong. My mother was constantly shamed. She was shamed for leaving my dad. She was shamed for, and then she was shamed into getting married for the second time, right? Like everyone was like, well, if your daughter doesn't have a father, and it's not like my dad wasn't around, but my dad also suffered from bipolar disorder. So it wasn't like he could be there for me in the way that a lot of other dads could, like someone that doesn't struggle with debilitating mental illness. So everyone in our family was telling my mom, like, now you have to get married again. She needs to have a father figure. You cannot do this on your own. And that kind of forced her to get married to this person. And even though she had doubts about the sustainability of that marriage and her own happiness and her own safety, she had to choose between that, her safety, her happiness, my happiness, and like being stigmatized for being alone and people constantly berating her for being alone. And then what happened? She was in an abusive marriage. How is that any better than being alone? And so that when she decided to leave that marriage, and then it was again like, okay, now you're moving back in with your parents and you have a daughter and you don't have any prospects for marriage. I think it really took a toll on my mom's self-esteem. And I feel like Indian women in general always have like an internal conflict when it comes to their self-worth, because we're not necessarily valued in the Indian community. You know, it's always like the boys that are valued. They're the breadwinners. They're the ones that take responsibility for their families. You know, women are seen as a burden. Young girls are seen as a burden. And so readapting was sort of getting comfortable with disagreeing with people, getting comfortable with, you know, if someone says that the only way you can be seen as, you know, you can be seen as valuable in the society is if you're a wife or if you're a mother. And if you're having that, you know, quintessential family familial identity, like, and getting comfortable with disagreeing with that and being like, that is just a perception. Like, that's just what you perceive. That is not actually a measure of the people within that family unit, what their happiness is, what their security is. And I think now, as I'm older, I've gotten better at like criticizing things that are normalized. I've gotten better at like questioning things that we see as normal. And I've gotten more comfortable with like throwing the word normal away. Like, I don't think it has to exist. I think a lot of the things that are perceived as normal are determined by structures that are actually really oppressive.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, when I took the time to reflect on the whole Indian matchmaking experience, you might have read it. I wrote this piece called The South Asian, you know, Cultural Arms Race for Impressive Biodata. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, one of my big sort of realizations, you know, was something you just said, which is that, you know, women are taught to tie their self-worth to whether or not they're married, mm-hmm. which, you know, I remember saying, you know, if you're an Indian mother reading this, ask yourself, what kinds of choices are your daughters going to make if you treat them as if though they have an expiration date? Mm-hmm. And what I wonder, you know, I wrote that from the perspective of a male. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what it's like to be an Indian woman because I'm not in your shoes. What do you have to do to unwind this narrative across an entire culture that has been, you know, basically a dominant narrative for probably hundreds of years at this point?
I think it takes resilience. And I think along with that resilience, it's about playing your cards right. So for me, I already have this. My mother's been married 3 times. You know, my dad had bipolar disorder. Then he passed away when I was 13. I've moved around so much in my life. Like, I have all these things that are like stacked against me that, you know, in the eyes of anyone who upholds those oppressive Indian values, you know, they would see me as less than. So those are the cards I have. Now I get to figure out what other cards I have that can help me. So for me, that was getting an education. And that was also like achievement, like making sure that I'm achieving the things that I want to achieve. It doesn't have to be what other people think as important, but they can be things that I think are important and I can do really well. For example, I'm a writer, and I thought to myself, if I'm going to be a writer, I have to make sure I'm the best damn writer. And that made me, you know, write on a blog every day in high school and get discovered by Rookie Mag. That made me go to college and then get my master's degree and finish my master's degree at the age of 23. Like, so even if people do see me as less than, and I have all these cards that are, you know, kind of like stacked against me, then I have all these other things too that it's about, I guess it's about picking your battles. Like, I'm not going, if I'm going to be seen as less than because I'm a child of divorce, then I'm going to make sure I get an education and I have that to lean on and anchor me. So that way I can have enough resilience, but then I can also have enough, I guess I can have enough to also like back me up if anyone tries to tell me that, like I'm nothing or I'm not valuable because I have an education and I'm worthy of being independent. I'm capable of being independent. So it's like, not if you are imperfect in the eyes of other people, you can find ways to balance it out. And for me, that was education and that was achievement and making sure I'm accomplishing enough to what my value, what my definition of accomplishment is.
Yeah. What did your mom teach you about relationships based on her experience after, you know, two divorces and a third, you know, third marriage?
She taught me a lot of things. And I think the first thing that she taught me was listen to your gut. Like, and I think that's how it all goes back to, you know, accepting that stigmas are real, but also accepting that they can be very wrong. So even if you do feel like you're rushed to get married or you're being rushed to do whatever, you can't listen to that sense of anxiety. You have to also lean into what your gut is telling you. So if there's a red flag, you have to pay attention to it. That red flag is way more important than the perceived comfort of being in a situation that makes you, or in a context that makes you more socially acceptable. Because that is temporary. Like my mother getting married for the second time, there was that comfort of, okay, I'm married again. Like it's fine now. And that quickly disappeared when she realized the kind of person she was married to. So that's the first thing, is listening to your gut. And the other thing is like knowing your value and knowing what you do deserve and not giving that up and always standing by that. I think there are a lot of people who are so entranced by the idea of like comfort and like the comfort of being in a situation that's societally acceptable that they just settle for anything and they settle for any situation or any person. And that can get you into a lot of trouble. And then that can ultimately lead you to being in a situation that is no longer societally acceptable, aka divorce. So not settling is a huge thing. And then she also told me that it's okay to wait. And I think this is also another big aspect. I think there's this idea of like you need to get married in your 20s and you need to have a stable job in your 20s and all of that needs to happen in your 20s. And my mom's like, you should spend your 20s getting to know yourself and getting to know what you want in life and also understanding your own value. Like you don't just wake up one day and say, this is what I deserve. This is who I am. This is where my value is. That takes time to build, especially if you've been in environments that have completely contradicted the ability to ever build that sense of self-esteem. So that's what I'm doing now. It's a lot of like reflection, a lot of figuring out what my values are, figuring out what my needs are, and also figuring out what my red flags are. Like what red flags do I give off to people? And once, you know, I hit my 30s and I can be a little bit more comfortable in who I am, and that's when I can really start thinking more about like who I want my life partner to be. But right now I'm in the phase of building my life and building my vision. And the person I am now is going to be completely different than the person I am in my 30s, even from the age of like 32 to 35, that could be completely different. So it's just a matter of like not making decisions for a person that I don't know and I don't know very well. And that's the future version of me.
Wow. I can relate. And I wish every Indian mother on the planet was hearing this conversation. So I want to come back to the second marriage, but let's talk about your time in India. You know, the reason that struck me so much is because when I was growing up in Edmonton, we had a family friend who, you know, they had two sons, and they moved to India, you know, much against their son's wishes, who, you know, had been socialized and brought up in Canada up until he was in like third or fourth grade, which is as you probably know firsthand, that's a really difficult thing. And this poor kid ran away from home in India and he never came back. I mean, I remember we went to India in seventh grade and he was missing. We went back when I was in ninth grade and they never found him.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, what I wonder from that is, what are the challenges of adapting to something like being in India and going to school in India when you were primarily socialized and brought up in America? I'd imagine that's incredibly disruptive to your childhood.
It was incredibly disruptive. And obviously, looking back, I like to focus on the good parts of it, but that doesn't take away from the reality of the situation. I think the biggest thing I had to adapt to, and that only happened after I realized what exactly I was adapting to, was the culture of shame. So there is so much shaming in Indian culture. And being someone who was arriving there, and, you know, I have to make it clear, like, not a lot of people know my mom's been married three times. A lot of people think my mom's only been married two times because her second marriage was so horrible. We just didn't want to talk about it for so long. And at that time, you know, people were under the impression that my mom had only been married once and my dad was still in America. And, you know, that's it. And then there was a single woman with his daughter. They came from America. And even with just that little bit of information, there was so much to go off of. I adapted to that culture of shame only by recognizing first what shame was. And how I did that was through multiple ways. The first was recognizing that the Indian community it can be very tight knit. Like there are so many people in the community, but they're so tightly knit that, you know, you can't get anything past them. Like everyone's watching you. I went to this school that mainly had, you know, politicians' kids, movie directors' kids. The only reason I got in was because my grandmother was classmates in college with the headmistress. And so she let me into the school. And so a lot of those, you know, kids who come from like a very like high financial status were at the school. And I came from like a very middle class family. And the mothers there specifically were very tightly knit. Like they always talked about what was going on. They talked about their kids. They talked about their kids' classmates. They talked about other parents. So when I joined school, it was like, okay, I immediately became a target for these parents. And my mom became a target too, because she was one of the only women that worked. My mom worked in an office. Most of the mothers were stay-at-home moms. And so the shame came up when there was a rumor spread around when I was maybe in the fifth grade that I had been seen naked in a room with a boy. I don't know who spread this rumor. It was probably one of my classmates, but then it got to the parents. And the parents went to the principal and was like, we can't have this American girl here. She's like corrupting our kids with her Americanness, because they always, you know, in India, they saw American culture as very corrupt. They saw it as like, what we might see as sexually liberating, they see as, you know, pornographic or inappropriate or whatever. And so they had just assumed, because I'm American, that I am like a product of that distorted, you know, idea that they had in their heads. And so they were like, we need to keep this girl away from our kids. You know, they would call my mother and be like, your daughter is a nuisance. And even though I was just doing whatever, and there were rumors being spread around me, it didn't matter that they were rumors. No one even asked if it was just a rumor. They just were so adamant about like me not being there and me being a bad influence on their kids. So that was, and then the shame started coming too, because they were like, not only was I American, but then I was also a child of divorce. And like, what kind of woman gets divorced? Like, only a woman who doesn't care what other people think and is probably breaking tons of other rules would do something like that. So, I mean, there was that rumor. There was plenty of other rumors that kids were spreading. You know, one time I like made a prank call to a boy and with like a couple of other friends, and we were like 11, 12 years old. But the mother only took my name out of the whole group, and they were like, oh, Upasana, the American girl, prank calling boys. Like, it was also like this whole like very heteronormative idea of like girls and boys are not supposed to hang out. And I was like very comfortable talking to boys because I wasn't raised with the idea of like, you know, I wasn't raised to think that it was inappropriate to talk to boys or that there was any like sexual implicitness with doing so. I didn't see it like that. And so it was like things that were very natural to me. And then also me just being me was automatically a threat and was automatically reason for me to get shamed and for my mother to be seen as like an incapable mother. And anything that may have been false was never critically thought about. It was sort of just taken as truth and people ran with it. And that was just, it was so much to adapt to because it was like, now I have to adapt to this culture of shame. I have to adapt to also like, these new ideas that like I didn't even know existed about the way you're supposed to be in society as a girl. Like I never grew up with that in America and my mom never taught me those things. And so that was very, very hard to get through.
Yeah. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, I always joke that I was like, how is it that a culture who wrote the manual on sex could be so sexually oppressed? Something clearly went wrong. Rumor has it we can blame the British, but right? I don't know if that's entirely true. Because I remember there's a Hasan Minhaj sketch, skit that he does where he's just like, you're an Indian guy. He's like, your entire life, your parents are like, don't talk to girls, don't talk to girls. And then you get to like 25 and like, how can you not have a girlfriend?
Right. Literally.
It's like, you salted our game our entire life. That's why.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about coming back. What was the reverse culture shock like of coming back?
So first was like, even when I was in America, I was in like a majority white community. That was like the first 9 years of my life. And I had a lot of, I had always associated America with like white people. And in India, like, whiteness is celebrated, not in terms of race, but in terms of like color, like being fair,
yeah.
Right? Like colorism and racism are two completely different things. But when they join forces, it's like even more like, I guess, harmful. And so I had also had that idea growing up that like, oh, white people are so cool. Americans are so cool. They're so free. They get to do whatever they want. Like, and like their parents let them go to parties and stuff. And obviously a lot of that idea about America had been built off of TV shows. And TV shows are not necessarily a reflection of reality. And so the reverse culture shock came when I went to a school that was 85% Black. And I went to a school that was very under-resourced. And I was seeing this side of America that I had no idea existed. And obviously, like, even if I hadn't gone to a school that was 85% Black, I'm sure there still would have been cognitive dissonance between what I was watching on TV and my reality either ways. But going to a school that was 85% Black, like, the Indian community is so anti-Black. Once again, in terms of race and color. And so I was also the only one of the two Indian kids in the school. At some point that became three. But, you know, it was a school of like almost 2000 kids. And then there was me and like one other Indian kid. And so the culture shock came with one realizing that the Black culture exists and it. At that time, like, was not being reflected in our TV shows and our movies. And if it was, it was completely caricaturized. And the other culture shock came from recognizing why our school was under-resourced, why so many of the Black students were in quote-unquote standard classes while I was in honors classes and AP classes. And then the other culture shock came from seeing police in my school and walking through a metal detector every morning and going on lockdown because there was a gun threat or a bomb threat or a shooter threat. That was America to me after a point. Not the TV shows, not white people being happy and doing their barbecues and their in their four-person family home with their dog, like all that imagery just dissolved and became this. And that was very hard to adapt to because in India, all I wanted was to go back to America. And then when I'm back, I'm like, this is not the America that I remembered. And this is not the America that I had in mind. And that was just, I mean, that's when I, you know, started reading more about the history of America. I mean, obviously, when I was in India, I was learning about Indian history and world history. And then you come to America, you're reading U.S. history and, you know, your textbooks may not even be that good. So you're kind of just flailing, trying to figure out what the truth of your country is. And yeah. I had wanted to be American for so long. And then I realized what being American actually meant.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you mentioned textbooks not telling the truth. I remember I read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which had apparently been banned in AP American history classes all across the United States because it was considered anti-American.
When
you read that book, it's disturbing. You know, when you go and trace 200 years of history, you find out things that are unpleasant to admit are in the history of your country.
Right.
So, second marriage, you mentioned, was abusive. And I think that what I've found, at least in Indian culture, is that we don't talk about things like this, again, because of stigma. We don't talk about mental health. What are we not seeing? What do you want people to see, you know, behind the scenes of Indian families that often get ignored until somebody like Mira Nair comes along and makes a film?
That's so funny you say that. I literally just watched Monsoon Wedding like 2 days ago.
that was literally the point of reference for me.
Love that. That's a great coincidence. I think the first thing is the tight hold that the patriarchy has on Indian culture. Like, obviously the patriarchy is this invisible structure that's manifested through individual actions, maybe policies sometimes too, universally. And in the Indian culture, that manifests through this sense of, you know, like boys being the most important and the most, dependable, you know, members of a family. Like, you have a son and he's going to grow up and take care of everyone, sort of thing. And what that does, it creates a very toxic sense of masculinity within men, which can result in the harm of not just the man himself, but everyone around him. So, you know, apart from, you know, my mom's second marriage, I know a lot of my Indian friends have dads who are not emotionally available. And if they do, it's like the most amazing, special thing in the world, instead of being what's supposed to be normal for any child to grow up with. There's a lot of not talking about your emotions or not talking about, you know, mental health isn't a thing that's discussed in Indian households. Like, a lot of parents will say, oh, you have anxiety? We didn't even have that word growing up. Like, you know, that word didn't exist. Like, you're stressed? What are you stressed about? I'm the one paying the mortgage. So there's a lot of that. And that is very, like, tied in very closely with masculinity, because there is this universal idea of, like, men are not supposed to show their emotions. Men are not supposed to talk about their feelings. Men are, you know, and then what that does is it creates a community of men that, one, because they've been like celebrated from the moment that they're born, it creates like a sense of entitlement. And also there's a lot of, you know, like young Indian boys with sisters, they can see the difference between how they're treated versus how their sisters are treated. And that can also contribute to a sense of entitlement, or even like this bias against women and what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do and what type of, you know, what their future is because of their gender. And then what it also does is, other than creating a community of men like that, it also makes room for secrets. Like, when you live in a culture that you're not supposed to talk about anything that's messy or uncomfortable, there's a lot of space for secrets. And I think that's why there's so much abuse in Indian households and no one talks about it, especially when it comes to women being abused. It's, you know, if you look at there's some Pew Research Center did a poll of like the marital status, or like how many Indian households are like two-person households, and it's like almost 90%. Like, most Indian kids come from a household with two parents. But I wonder if we came from a community where people talked about mental health, talked about toxic masculinity, and, you know, refused abuse as just a part of life. And that's just how it is. And, you know, marriage is either going to be whatever it is. I wonder if that number would be greatly reduced, if there would be more divorces in the Indian community because of that, or even maybe less marriages in the first place at a young age. It's just all of it is so messy and it's so intertwined that when you see something horrible happen to someone else or to yourself, you just don't even know which part of the system to blame.
Yeah. So, I mean, being raised in an environment like that, you know, with everything else that also happened prior, how do you begin to recover your sense of self-worth?
I don't know. I feel like I'm still working on it sometimes because it's a part of me is like, in order to recover my sense of self-worth, like I have to be more comfortable with talking about it. Like, yes, for 3 years of my life, I lived in a very abusive household where my mother was being abused and I was just a kid and I was, you know, observing that, or like my mother protected me as much as she could. But like kids are observant and they figure things out quite easily. And I was also like a very intuitive kid. So, you know, a lot of my self-worth was affected because of feeling like my situation wasn't normal. Even though, like I said, abuse is quite common. It's just not talked about. Doesn't mean it's okay, but that doesn't mean it's uncommon. I think talking about it is what is going to help me. But I sometimes just don't know where to start or how to start. Because it's not something that you can just say without people being like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry you had to go through that. Or, oh my gosh, like, are you okay? You know, because I am okay. I'm breathing. I'm fine. Like, I'm very happy. It's just that this one part of my life was very scary and very, like, it completely changed who I am as a person. Like, I wouldn't be the person I am today if I hadn't gone through that as a child. So I think building my self-worth comes from, one, acknowledging that it's not uncommon what I went through. It's just that there's not many people who talk about it. But also, two, the more I talk about it, perhaps the more easily I can embrace that part of my life without, you know, feeling like I deserved it or whatever. Because it's not like... I hate to say that like my trauma defines me and it defines who I am. Like, I don't think that's the case. I think it's how you deal with it and the lessons that you learn about life through it. If you let yourself, that is what helps you rebuild your self-worth.
Yeah. How old were you when your mom got remarried for the third time?
I was 14.
Okay. And, you know, having seen, you know, two marriages that didn't work, what was your sort of initial reaction to the idea that your mom was going to get remarried again? And what skepticism did you have, or what sort of protective mechanisms did you have when this new person comes into your life?
It's a good question. I mean, the biggest thing was like, I was getting a stepbrother, and that's what I wanted, right? Like, it was the nuclear family, like dad, mom, brother, sister, like that's perfect. And that's what I was getting. So there was a little bit of excitement with that of like, oh, now maybe I can hide under this veil of normalcy and I don't have to talk about. And like by the time my mom was getting married for the third time, like my dad had passed away. So it kind of felt like I missed my dad and I really wanted some sense of normalcy. And like my mom getting married for the third time was giving me that. And so that was exciting, like the prospect of hiding under the veil of normalcy. But I guess the coping mechanisms or the protective mechanisms kind of came about when I was in that situation. Like I didn't really feel like I needed them at all because I was so excited by the idea until I was actually in that situation. And I was like, oh, wow. Now I have to be on the lookout for like anything that could go wrong or anything that could cause me to lose this sense of normalcy. And so it's like whenever my mom and my stepdad have like a very normal argument, like I would freak out and I'd be like, oh, no, it's happening again. And I would just like hide in my room or just do whatever. And then it wouldn't happen. Like it would be fine. And so I feel like in a way I was always ready. Like my fight or flight was like always ready to get triggered at like any point. And I was pretty much in like survival mode, like even in high school, like I was in that survival mode that I was at home, like came with me to high school, like in school. So like the way I was communicating with my peers and the friendships I was making was very reflective of like my state of mind of like this could go away at any second. And then what am I supposed to do? Like I might have to leave again. But over time, like, I just built trust with my stepdad and I noticed that he had a very deep respect for like stability and a deep respect for family and like depending on one another. So that really helped. But like my parents have been married for 10 years now and only maybe when I left to college. So after maybe like 4 years did I feel like I could kind of relax and like this was my life now instead of feeling like, okay, I have to be ready for something to go wrong at any given moment.
Is your stepdad Indian?
He is. He's Singaporean, actually, but he's of Indian descent.
Yeah, because I was wondering if he wasn't. I was wondering, like, you know, how you integrate, you know, different cultures. Let's talk about your career trajectory, you know, post high school. I mean, you mentioned that you started a blog and started writing in high school, which, you know, I think that's not normal for most high school kids to be that ambitious. So what was the narrative about careers around your house? So, I mean, it doesn't sound, you know, like you had the typical doctor, lawyer, engineer narrative.
No. And it's funny because like in the beginning, that was actually the narrative from my mom. And I think that came from like her feeling like her life was always in flux, that she just wanted me. She was like to have this like sense of stability. So growing up, she was like, you should do something like, if you want to be a doctor, that's great, but you should study something that's going to give you a sense of stability. And that was like economics. My mom was like, you should study economics because my uncle studied economics and he's doing really well in his life. My grandpa studied economics. And my mom studied English and she's like, look where English got me, which I don't think. I'm like, please don't say that. The arts are dying. But so in the beginning, the career trajectory was like very like you need to do the thing that's going to keep you stable. Don't dream. But only out of fear. Like my mom just wanted me to be stable. But then as I started, like, I've always been writing. I've been writing since the age of 5. Like, I would make up stories. I would do, like, adaptations from TV shows I saw. Like, but then when I started writing personal essays, that's when my mom was like, oh, this is, like, this makes you so happy. You should just do that. And so it kind of came to a point where I formed this career vision of, like, I'm going to study something like economics that will allow me to have like a philosophy about the way the world works that I can lean on and depend on tangibly in terms of getting a job. Like it is easier to get a job with an economics degree, but also intangibly, like now I can have an understanding of the way the world works and like all of that. And then the other side of it was I'm going to use that economics degree as an anchor to do what I actually like doing, which is writing. And later that became acting. And so my mom came to a point where she was like, you need to do what makes you happy, because the culprit of everything that's happened in my life as your mother is me not choosing myself and me not choosing you know, what I'm good at. My mother was a ballerina and she had to give that up. She was a ballerina for like 20 years and she wanted to like be a professional dancer and she couldn't because she got into this marriage with my dad and, you know, her in-laws were very demanding. And she was like, what if I just said no? So she was like, you need to do what makes you happy, but you need to be really, really good at it. Like if you're going to be a writer, like I said earlier, like you need to be the best writer. And that's like, that's the mentality I took and ran with. So, my career vision is that it's, practicality mixed with, openness toward myself and also toward the world. And always having something that I can lean on in case things go awry, but also knowing that I have these gifts that I'm supposed to use and that will make me happy if I use them.
Funny, you and I have the economics degree in common.
Wait, you have an economics degree? That's hilarious. Well, that's awesome.
An environmental econ degree because my grades were so bad at Berkeley that I, you know, it was the only major where you know, I could get in with all the prerequisites I'd taken. Funny enough, I know a lot more about economics now than I did back then. Like I've literally sat down and read The Wealth of Nations cover to cover. And because I run a business, it makes so much more sense.
Right. Real life application.
Exactly. Well, I have two final questions for you. What impact has this had on the, you know, the way that you were raised and the experience that your mother had and the experience you had growing up had on your own relationships?
Wow. I'd say the first, do you mean like romantic relationships or like all kinds?
Romantic relationships. Yeah.
Well, up until literally last year, the impact was like pretty negative. Like my mom had given me all these lessons, like I had talked about earlier, but I wasn't really sure how to implement them. So up until like last year, I feel like my subconscious was really like taking me for a trip in that, you know, that sense of normalcy that I always craved as a kid, like I carried it with me into like early adulthood. So I was always looking for relationships that looked good. Like I wasn't really worried about how I felt with the person. I was more worried about how the relationship looked. And if it looked good to other people, I felt good. So I had like two major relationships in college. And the first person, like I felt like the whole image was like power couple image. Like I really wanted that feeling of like finding my significant other in college and like getting married and like everyone being like, wow, you've always had it together. And that, you know, after a year dissolved. And what I took from that was, okay, now I can't be so focused on utility. Like relationships can't be all about utility and how well you work together and how many cool things you can do together that make other people impressed. It has to be more than that. But once again, I had learned a lesson, but wasn't exactly sure how to implement it. So my second relationship in college was with a white person. And that relationship, while I was in it, was, I mean, amazing. Like I felt really secure and I felt loved and his family was amazing. But when the relationship ended, I realized that I wasn't actually being treated the way that I should have been in that he came from a nuclear family and he secretly was not even secretly, actually quite openly. I think it was just more like, I guess, what's the word for it? Covert. But there was like a lot of covert racism. They kind of saw me as like, oh, the Indian girl who had a lot of problems. How lucky is she to be dating this person in our family who's so secure and stable? Because, you know, he was a very sheltered person in comparison to me. He had lived in the same house his whole life, in the same town his whole life. He wasn't really interested in ever leaving, you know, the state of Illinois. And so I think a part of him and a part of his family was like, okay, she's lucky to be with him because we're giving her a sense of stability that her own family couldn't give her. Like we're showing her what stability looks like. And I think I met them halfway because I was secretly insecure about my family background, even though I've been openly working toward accepting it and embracing it, I was still insecure. And I still had that like childlike mentality of like, oh, I just want to be normal. I just want to be like the American sitcom that I had grown up seeing and feeling so comforted by. And then so once we broke up, a lot of the stuff that happened in that relationship, I started being able to identify as wrong or racist even. And I mean, one of the things he said to me when we broke up was like, you don't get along with any of my friends. I was like, yeah, all your friends are like white dudes that play video games all day. Like, what do you expect me to do? Like, what do I have in common with them? Like, and so I loved that. While I was in the relationship, I loved how being with him almost felt like I could hide behind his identity. And in a way, like I was being accepted by this part of society that I could never get access to. But then once we broke up, I think I realized that that's all that was.
Wow. Wow. Well, this has been mind-blowingly insightful and thought-provoking. So I have one final question for you, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's the person's ability to be themselves no matter what context they're in or what situation they're in that might force them to be otherwise. It's the resilience of staying true to oneself and acknowledging what's going on in your gut. That's what makes someone unmistakable. And that's what makes them get through anything that might defy their natural way of being.
Wow. Kind of left me speechless. I can't thank you enough for one, you know, writing and telling me about your story, but also taking the time to join us and share it with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
You can find me on Instagram at Upasana Bharath or just on my website, upasanabharath.com. Thank you so much for having me, Srini.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.